Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast. I'm Zach Elwood, the host. Before we get to the interview, I wanted to say hello and give a little information about my podcast. It's always been my belief that almost everyone has interesting stories to tell, and it just depends on what you ask them about and how deeply you dive into the subject matter. I was influenced from a young age by reading Studs Terkel's 1974 book, Working. The full, kind of awkward title of that book was Working. People talk about what they do all day and how they feel about what they do. It was a bunch of interviews with everyday people talking about their jobs. My original concept for this podcast was that it would include talking to normal people, not only just well-known people or celebrities. Mainly just everyday regular people doing whatever it is they're interested in or experienced at, and talking about hidden psychological tricks and shortcuts to how they approach what they do. Because I really do believe that, just like is shown in Studs Terkel's book, there are tons of interesting anecdotes and strategies hiding out there, sometimes in some unexamined everyday situations. Another influence on me was Sigmund Freud. He gets a bum rap sometimes with everyone's focus on the Oedipal and the penis stuff, but he was, in my opinion, a great examiner of behavior. My dad had a bunch of random Freud books lying around the house, a bunch of random books in general, and Freud influenced me to think more about the psychology in everyday situations. One great book for that is The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. It's a great read with a lot of examination on verbal slips that give away meaning in everyday situations. So my point with this introduction is to give you some more context for my purposes with this podcast, and to maybe explain why you'll sometimes hear me interview regular people and not just aim for well-known people or, you know, well-known experts. I actually think sometimes you can get a lot more interesting stuff from regular people, because some well-known people can have more to hide and reasons to be political, whereas more everyday people will let all the secrets slip sometimes. They don't care as much sometimes about people's perceptions. I'm always on the lookout for interesting ideas for people to interview. And another reason for doing this introduction is to let you know that those ideas for interviews don't have to be well-known people. They can be everyday people who just use a lot of psychology and reading of other people in their jobs. Maybe you know someone who's worked as a border agent for decades or was a hugely successful used car salesman. I'm on the lookout for stories like those where someone's willing to go into detail about their work and the thoughts behind it. If you have any ideas for good interviews, please send them to me via my contact page at readingpokertells.com/contact. And again, if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a rating for it on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to it on. I honestly haven't gotten too much feedback about the podcast, so it's hugely appreciated if you do that. Okay, let's get to the podcast. Okay, welcome to another edition of the People Who Read People podcast. This is Zach Elwood, and today is April 17th, 2019. And today I'm going to have on Robin Dibble, who's done pretty much every position possible in the restaurant and service industry business, mostly in the Albuquerque and Phoenix areas. He's managed a lot of restaurants, including P.F. Chang's for 3 years and several Italian restaurants, including Buca di Beppo, if you know that one. He's managed and bartended at one of the busiest nightclubs in Albuquerque, the Library Bar and Grill. Most recently, he helped oversee the opening and operation of a Poke Fusion restaurant in Albuquerque called Poke Poblano. And that restaurant did quite well. It got an average of 4.5 stars and 184 Yelp reviews in about its 10 months of operation. But unfortunately, ended up closing just a couple weeks ago because apparently the restaurant industry is quite tough. And most people, I think, know that. Personally, I've known Robin for about 15 years from when I lived in Albuquerque. We actually met through the poker scene. That was around the time when I first started playing at casinos and moving up in stakes a bit compared to the smaller home games I'd played before that. And Robin always struck me as a very smart and observant guy. He always had a lot of great stories to tell about the restaurant business. And just recently, my wife and I were actually brainstorming an idea for opening up a restaurant in Portland here, Portland, Oregon. And I called up Robin to consult on the idea, and we actually met up and talked about a lot of ideas, and he was a huge help and brought a lot of insider knowledge. And he also makes himself available for other similar consultation work for restaurant opening and operation and just general strategies around that. Hey, Robin, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Zach, thanks for having me.
So today, Robin and I are going to be talking about psychology and understanding customer behavior in the restaurant and service industry. And obviously, a lot of success in the restaurant business is about perception and how customers subjectively feel about the experience based on the decor and the atmosphere and their interactions with servers. So it's no surprise there's a lot of psychology in the business. It's a people business. So we'll talk about perceptions and manipulating perceptions. So first, I thought it'd be cool to start out with that anecdote you told me about your early days of serving at Italian restaurant Buca di Beppo and about waiter who was popular with the kids.
Sure.
Yeah.
When I was first learning how to serve and wait tables, you know, I had worked my way up from a busser and I was super eager to, you know, do well. And every shift that I worked, I would do okay. You know, I would do pretty respectable money. The sales were decent, but my tip average was always a little bit lower than, you know, my counterparts. One thing I noticed from a server that I worked with named Nick is this guy was super friendly, you know, very, very kind of upbeat guy. And he had a way with families that no one else could seem to accomplish. So, you know, when you get a table of families with kids, you know, sometimes you have to prep yourself for, there's sometimes more things you have to take care of. So often, you know, servers don't really find themselves loving tables of families. I had hit or miss experiences with families myself, you know, never really could understand why I didn't ever make great tips from families. And I started to watch Nick, and Nick would have people eating out of the palm of his hand. I mean, families with kids just adored him, and the kids would always request him on their next visit. And he would have regulars constantly coming in, that families with young kids that just loved him. And I couldn't ever really figure it out. One day I was watching Nick, he was in the section right next to me, and I'd just taken an order. And I noticed that Nick always kept a crayon behind his ear. And we had crayons for families because, you know, kids want to color on the, you know, coloring pages and do tic-tac-toe and stuff. But Nick would always grab one of the green or blue crayons out of the pack, stick it behind his ear, and he would wear that crayon behind his ear the entire shift. He never wrote with it. It never got used. It was just there. And it definitely made him appear more friendly. It made him more approachable. You know, when kids saw that, they immediately had a connection with this guy because, oh, look, he likes, you know, he likes crayons too, I guess. But it was just that subtle little difference of, you know, a psychological approach to the job that really struck me and really got my, you know, my wheels turning as far as like, okay, what are the techniques that I can use? And honestly, I stole the crayon idea. I put one behind my ear, and for the next 2 weeks, I made better tips on average. I did use stuff like that from time to time. And that was just one of those, that was like really early on in my serving career. And I think that really opened my eyes up to the other side of, you know, the job of serving. You know, that there's, it's one thing to just bring everything they ask for and kind of be there if they need you. But it's another thing to really, you know, try and, you know, influence their experience and kind of influence their perception of you. It goes a long way and actually can make you a lot more money.
Right. Yeah. It makes you think that there must be a ton of other little psychological tricks you can do to make people respond to you and get a higher tip.
There's absolutely a ton. Some of the best companies that, you know, that I've worked for that did that were some of the corporate ones that had a lot of, you know, thought behind the service and the thought behind, you know, the steps of service. But some of the stuff that I've seen, you know, actually taught in restaurants is a concept they call tip talk, where you use phrases and words to kind of highlight the things you're doing without being obvious or nagging about it. You know, instead of, for instance, if somebody says, you know, they'd like another refill or something and you notice that they need some more lemons, right? Instead of saying, you know, I'll bring you some more lemons or, you know, would you like some more lemons? You would go grab the refill, you'd grab the lemons. And when you bring them back, instead of just saying, here's your lemons, you would say, you know, oh, you know what? I noticed you needed some more lemons. I went ahead and brought that for you. You know, I went ahead and, you know, filled this up for you. I went ahead and grabbed this box for you because, you know, it's just saying the things that you're already doing, but just kind of highlighting it from a stance of, you know, oh, I went ahead and touched the care to do this for you. It's a very subtle, but obvious at the same time kind of technique that really kind of starts to implant the seed in the guest's mind that, you know, this person is going above and beyond for me, or this person is doing more than the average server for me. You know, the last time I ate here, the server maybe wasn't communicating as well.
It kind of reminds me of, like, I worked for some neuro-linguistic programming hypnotherapy seminar guy, and he was big into these, like, you know, subtle uses of words. I mean, a lot of that stuff to me was bullshit, but there definitely was some good truth in there, like the more realistic applications of that, you know, framing things, basically how you want them to be framed.
Definitely. I mean, even subtle words like, you know, instead of saying no problem, I started to get into the habit of saying absolutely. Because I noticed that, you know, the phrase no problem kind of had an off-putting effect on some people, not on everybody. You know, I noticed that younger groups, millennial groups, tend to find no problem a much better response, you know, because it seems kind of more, you know, dialed into their kind of specific mode of communication. But, you know, baby boomers didn't really appreciate the no problem aspect. They kind of took it as like, yeah, well, I know it shouldn't be a problem. Like, why are you telling me it's no problem? It's your job, you know? And then other, right. You know, it just depends. And again, it goes back to reading people. You know, you have to kind of change your approach and change how you operate based on you know, on who's sitting in front of you.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I can see from older people expect a little bit more formality and saying no problem. It implies really subtly, like, I didn't have to do this for you, you know,
sure.
or something.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Huh. Any other tip talk? Because I think that stuff's really interesting. Anything else spring to mind?
Yeah, I mean, there's subtle hints throughout the meal that you can pick up on, and you know, ultimately, you know, and it obviously ties very well with your podcast. You know, the entire art of serving really is about reading people, and not just serving but managing. You know, you really have to gauge if somebody's, you know, in a hurry, if somebody's upset, if somebody looks agitated. You know, you have to use all these subtle clues. And it starts with as soon as they walk in the door. You know, I would actually employ the host staff to really start the process right then and there and get as many clues and as much information about their experience as possible before they even sit down, so that the server can go in there kind of understanding what the parameters are and what the expectation is. You know, if they walk in and the guest mentions right away, oh, we've got a flight to catch at, you know, 1:30, we're just trying to grab a quick lunch. Well, absolutely, the server is going to approach that table very differently than someone mm-hmm. coming in to celebrate, you know, a 40th wedding anniversary, you know, things of that nature. So reading the expectation is important. Reading, you know, how much time you might have. While we're on the subject of P.F. Chang's, one of the other things that I found really interesting is, you know, they would take it further for a management standpoint, and they would have kind of a culture where we had, you know, as a manager, we were kind of tasked to look for triggers. And, you know, triggers are basically something that happens or some situation that would trigger a response from us to maybe go above and beyond, you know, the general, you know, call of duty. So it can be something very simple as maybe a couple's coming in and they mention, you know, they're celebrating an anniversary, but it's, you know, it's not a big deal. And they're just having a nice dinner, and some part through the meal, you know, maybe one of the guests says, you know, I've always wanted to try that dish, but I just never ordered. I always get the same thing. So a trigger in that respect for a manager would, you know, the server would say, hey, this guy mentioned that he really wanted to try this, you know, this dish. And I was wondering if maybe we could just, you know, get him one for free or maybe a half portion, just so they could try it out, you know? And that was our opportunity to kind of go above and beyond and wow the guests a little bit and say, you know what, you mentioned it, we wanted you to try it, take it home. If you're not, you know, if you have too much food, it's on us tonight. And that really leaves like a lasting impression. You know, that's a huge psychological benefit for restaurants to hone in on, is that, you know, that loyalty of, man, those guys really took care of me and I really appreciated it. And I'm definitely going back. I'm definitely going to recommend them.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting talking about how, you know, corporations are understanding some of that behind the scenes strategy. I was reading this, I shared this with you, this Wall Street Journal article about servers reading people. And I'll just quote a paragraph or so here. It says, even chain restaurants like Denny's, TGI Fridays, and Romano's Macaroni Grill are focusing more on personalized service by training staff to note body language, eye contact, and offhand remarks, hoping to make service feel less mechanical. Traditionally, eateries taught waiters to follow a script and push add-ons like desserts and drinks. Some restaurants still employ waiter scripts, but now they are being used to dig for guest information. At Romano's Macaroni Grill, an Italian-themed chain, waiters are taught to use their scripted offer of house wine to find out if the table will want a fast, leisurely, or lively meal. If they say no, well, we're going to the theater, then the waiter knows dinner is not the main event, says Brandon Coleman III, chief marketing officer for the company. To speed up service, the waiter may bring the check at the same time as the food. So it was just kind of interesting to me, like tying into what you were saying, you know, some of these softer skill, psychological things, like were probably things the you know, we're thought of as something to not focus on at a corporate level, but it seems like as the corporations, you know, learn more and more, they're recognizing like, well, this stuff's really important to, you know, brand loyalty and emotions and people leaving reviews. So we got to work this into our strategies.
Absolutely. And a lot of that stuff comes from guest feedback. You know, I mean, after years and years of people, you know, having the same common complaints, you know, a lot of those complaints were often just told to your friends. I mean, before the onset of Yelp and all the review sites, it was really one of those situations where a good experience, you know, a guest would tell a few people, and a bad experience, they would tell everyone they came in contact with. You know, it was, it's one of those things that you just knew that, you know, bad experiences spread like wildfire. And so once social media and online reviewing kind of came to the forefront, I feel like a lot of these companies really started to see a much larger sampling of, you know, the common complaints. What is a common issue that people have? Well, you know, I had to wait too long to pay my check on a lunch break. That's a very common complaint. You know, I would always tell my servers in training, you can make people wait to sit down for over an hour, which is insane to me. You know, after years of working in restaurants, I don't tend to wait that long anymore, but people will wait hours to sit down. You know, they'll wait for food, they'll wait for drinks, they'll wait for service, and they'll do it generally just kind of under the expectation that that's what happens. But waiting to pay their check is literally the only thing people don't want to do. And I tend to agree. It's when you're done with your meal and you're ready to go, the last thing you want to do is just sit there, you know, almost kind of like in a prison, just waiting to give them their money. You know, I always said you should never make someone wait, you know, to give you their money. That's rule number one.
And from that same Wall Street Journal article, it had something about that in it too. It said one of the quotes was, when researchers ask customers which restaurant service mistake is worst in terms of overall satisfaction, they said not promptly settling the check when the guest is ready to leave. So that's real interesting. Yeah,
Well, I'm sorry. It also touches on the fact that that's the last experience that they're having before they walk out the door. You know, right. So they could have had a great dinner and it could be tarnished in, you know, some respect just because they were frustrated right before they left.
So how has social media changed how you approach the restaurant business? Do you feel like it's made you more thoughtful about individual experiences, or has it not changed much at all in your opinion?
You know, it's become challenging, and I've seen social media work really well for businesses now. And I've also seen social media be very hard on businesses where in the past that negative feedback wouldn't travel nearly as far. I think it's a difficult subject for a lot of business owners now, because the younger business owners are very in tune to social media, and they're very reactionary based on feedback online. Whereas some of the old school business owners might not put a lot of stock into the online reviews. And that can be good or bad. You know, I've seen kind of out of touch business owners who aren't as technology, you know, based and don't have an understanding of how social media can affect them, really put a negative image out there without realizing it, just in some of their responses and some of how they operate, you know, in the public eye. And that can be pretty damaging in the long run. You know, it's maintaining your online, you know, persona goes really far for businesses. You know, obviously most technology businesses and a lot of new businesses now are very social media based, and maintaining your reputation is a huge part of it. But restaurants are kind of in that half and half stage where, you know, half of the restaurants coming up are now very, very much online driven. And the restaurants that have been doing it forever are either catching up to that or just saying, you know what, we've made it this far without it. It's not part of what we do and we don't have to worry about it. I really think it's a mix. You know, I've often heard people say, and I tend to agree, you know, likes and views don't translate to dollar signs. And they don't. You know, it's very easy to put a flashy video out there to get your network to support it, to share it. You know, suddenly you boost it with a few $100 on Facebook ads and you've reached 20,000 people. But how many of those people are actually coming in your restaurant? You know, most people are just saying, oh, that looks cool, I'm going to like it, continue to scroll, and right, then never change their dining habits at all based on it. You know,
let's get back to the reading customers. Are there any tips or anything you look for, like say you're a manager or a server and you're looking around the room, are there any kind of like long distance signs that people are unhappy or irritated and you go help them out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's hundreds. You know, there's honestly, all of these are very relatable to, you know, any kind of tells. There's a lot of those types of tells that come into the dining experience. I mean, yeah, obviously if somebody's sitting there with their arms crossed and frowning, that's a very clear indication that something's wrong. But it goes much more subtly than that. I think, you know, often if I see people just kind of looking around the room, if I look at a table and I see more than one head up away from their food or away from the people at the table and looking around the dining room, I know that entire table is on alert for their server, or they're looking for something that hasn't been delivered yet, or maybe they're waiting too long for something. They become very obvious. I don't know. Maybe there's more subtlety than I'm giving them credit to at times. But I would be able to scan a room pretty quickly and figure out where I needed to be next. I think that was what, you know, I've learned how to be the most effective is really just, you know, is just engaging with everybody. I'm never one of those people that kind of just stand and watch a room too much. I think you can learn some of that, but I think you learn a lot more by actually approaching the table. I would get a lot more clues if I walked towards the table, because if they immediately noticed me walking up, then I knew they were waiting to tell me something. You know, if they were kind of surprised to see me, but then looked up and they seemed, you know, obviously all smiles, then I just kind of scan the table for, can I clear a plate? Can I refill a drink? Can I do something? You know, can I grab something to kind of make my trip you know, worth it. Obviously, you know, you never really want to go to a table empty-handed or anything. Leave a table empty-handed. You know, one or the other. You should probably, you know, have something in your hands, either going or coming or both. But yeah, there's lots of kind of subtle clues. You know, I will always scan a plate, you know, and I'll see how much of that plate has been touched. You know, is there an area of that plate that clearly is completely untouched while the other portion is, you know, kind of demolished, and, you know, or is most of the dish completely uneaten and they're just sitting there kind of poking around at it. You know, there's a lot of physical clues that, you know, oh, is everything okay with that? You know, is that, you know, is it cooked to your liking, or, you know, is that taste okay? Or was it too spicy? You know, I just start asking questions. You have to be specific. And as soon as you start getting specific, you immediately can tell before they open their mouth and respond, you know, just the body language, you know, the shoulders kind of, you know, a little defensive looking, or the head kind of, you know, cocked to the side going, you know, you immediately know, like, okay, I need to address that. And part of the psychology for me is I think a lot of people get on the defensive, or people feel weird pointing out an issue. You know, there's a lot of times when there might be something kind of not blatantly wrong with the food, but maybe it just wasn't hot enough, or maybe it just didn't taste very good. And people don't want to complain because a lot of times they think, well, I ordered it, you know, I chose this dish, and so I'm committed to it. But
and they're just polite in general, exactly. Too polite kind of thing. Yeah.
And so, and a lot of those people, you know, if I approach it and say, would you like me to remake it? The answer a lot of times is no, don't worry about it. That's fine. What I started doing was just saying, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and remake that for you. And, you know, sometimes the answer is still no, but I just say, you know what, it's fine. I'm, you know, I'm just going to remake it. And if they fight you tooth and nail, then, you know, I probably just take it off the check. But in some way I have to just go ahead and kind of circumvent.
Go with your read.
Yeah, exactly. Go with my read and just know that, like, I'm going to go ahead and just do this, because there's been so many times in the past when I was learning how to manage and growing up in the businesses and kind of filling my way out, where I thought I had addressed a problem. They assured me that they were completely satisfied. And then the next day the corporate office gets an email saying, you know, basically stating that, you know, they had a great meal, things were okay, but there was just this one thing that didn't work out well, and they just wanted somebody to know. And it's like, you know, I appreciate the feedback, but then my corporate office has to send me an email, and then I have to send them an email, and then I have to invite them back in, when in reality, I could have just comped that dish, taken off the check, and then they're not going to
write doing you any favors.
No, exactly. Yeah. And people don't, I don't think people always realize that, you know, instant feedback is the most valuable thing you can do for a restaurant, you know? There's also a lot of psychological clues that, you know, you cue in on that when people aren't unhappy. You know, you can also kind of read when people are, you know, wanting to give you that feedback. So it's kind of a nice opportunity when you have the guests that are willing to give it, you know, you kind of notice that they are just, you know, all smiles and very happy. And then you can sit there and have just a nice conversation about it and, you know, about their experience. And that allows you to kind of make a connection and, you know, kind of get some of that, that shroud of, you know, where this big business that doesn't really care about you, and you connect on a personal level, and they become fans of you, the individual, you know. And that's how, I think that's the biggest benefit for servers, is really finding how to bring people back that are there for them. You know, the people are often your biggest asset. You know, you spend, you know, one of your highest expenses in restaurants is definitely labor. So if you can invest in good people, you know, it works wonders, because those people invest in their guests, and those guests in turn, you know, reinvest in those people. And so, you know, I've seen a lot of great relationships bud out of, you know, a bartender regular, you know, relationship, or a server regular relationship, where, you know, these people just kind of become people that they're friends with, and eventually, you know, kind of like family members. I've had regulars end up, you know, selling houses to servers, or, you know, offering to help people buy cars, or, you know, just inviting people to their weddings. You know, I had a server who got married, and there was at least 5 or 6 people at the wedding that were just customers at the restaurant, but had been customers of his for 5 years, you know, and I'm sure they'd over time paid, you know, countless bills of his. So definitely cool.
I would think working so long in the restaurant, you would get kind of a sixth sense about seeing what people need at, like, almost like this unconscious level, you know, just kind of instinctually, like, look around and be like, oh, these people are unhappy, these people are getting ready to leave, whatever, you know, it must just come second nature to
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Well, it's part of the planning too, you know, in the how you operate the restaurant, you know, your host staff has to look and kind of be able to read the table and see, okay, are they finished? Are they, you know, are they about to get up? Where's my next table going to open up so I can seat them? You know, so there's a lot that kind of comes inherently. You know, you just learn to read people. Well, even, you know, even the state requires you to do that as a server and a bartender. When it comes to alcohol sales, you have to read people. All right. You have to. It's illegal not to, because if you overserve somebody, you know, you are faced with potential jail time. I mean, you know, it's one of those situations that can be, you know, really ugly. So, you know, as a bartender or a server, serving alcohol, the entire process is about reading people. You know, what do their eyes look like? How are they talking? What's their body language? Mm. What do they smell like? You know, a physical read.
Right. But how are they acting?
Yeah, how are they acting? Yeah. You know, and when people are drinking, are they having a good time? Are they having too much of a good time? Are they upset? You know, there's so many factors that come into play, especially from, you know, the bartending standpoint, where, you know, your job is a little bit more volatile when you're serving mm-hmm. alcohol. You know, it becomes pretty important.
So that's not just about the amount, because theoretically they could have a high tolerance.
Correct.
Or whatever. So it's mainly about behavior, keeping an eye on how they're acting.
It's both.
You know, yeah.
Like you said, you don't know what that person was doing before they got there. So really that's where the behavioral mm-hmm. stuff comes into play. But if you're starting, you know, from scratch, and let's say that the first drink they're having is in your restaurant, then you do kind of do the math breakdown. And actually the training has gotten pretty good on that. It used to kind of just be, you know, well, males have this tolerance and females have a lower one, and this body weight, you know, you can have this many drinks per pound, basically per hour. It's gotten a little bit more developed than that. I think, you know, they've started to take into factor, you know, weight a little bit more and size, and, you know, and then they started training more on the emotional side of it. Cause I'm not 100% sure on this, but I've been told that there's studies that say that if, you know, obviously if somebody's in a bad mood and they start drinking, the bad mood can get worse, or they can become drunk faster. You know, sometimes your emotions can make alcohol, you know, come into play more quickly, I guess. Another interesting thing that I've learned through that training was that when you're sitting down in a bar seat with your legs dangling, oftentimes it cuts off circulation to your legs. And so somebody could be sitting there having drinks and, you know, appear to be just fine. And maybe they sat still in that same seat for about 2 or 3 hours. And when they stand up, I believe the police officer that we talked to, he called it the wobbles. They stand up and all of the blood kind of rushes down, you know, downward for a bit, and you get kind of lightheaded and you feel suddenly much drunker. There's also a sphincter muscle in your, you know, somewhere in your digestive tract that when you're sitting, it's generally closed off. And when you stand, it actually opens up. And so the combination of the blood rush and then, you know, kind of a dumping of alcohol into your system can appear to make people look way more drunk than they actually are, you know, or maybe act way more drunk for a period of time until it kind of corrects itself. You know, it's interesting. Cutting people off is delicate. And I really like the approach of just handing somebody a card. And it's basically like a business card that just says, you've been cut off. Please leave respectfully and quietly, and no one has to know. I think that that's a really smart choice, because then it lets somebody sit there and digest the decision. It allows them to choose if they want to be loud about it. And if they don't want to have an embarrassing interaction, then they just respectfully pay their tab, say thanks and go. And
it's less confrontational.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it public, et cetera. Yeah. So I know menu strategy is a big area. Obviously, there's some people that are full-time, you know, there's businesses that are like full-time menu consultants, just because there's so much psychology there.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about things you've heard of or seen or worked on that come into play for menus?
Yeah, menus are the story of your business. It's how you tell your tale. It's how you tell the guests what you are about. It's how you communicate what your culture is. It's how you communicate everything, really. And so it's a very important piece of the business. And I think a lot of people don't put enough stock into the fact that this is a really important piece that needs to be dealt with, you know, really, really intelligently. And it's a hard thing to figure out, because every concept kind of garners a different approach and a different respect to what you highlight. You know, I kind of touched on it earlier, but if you're a French restaurant, your menu is going to have a lot of words that, you know, might not be layman's terms. They might be, you know, kind of more refined, and they have that air of, you know, elitism a little bit. Like if you don't understand what these dishes are, this sauce is, then your education is, you know, you might not know enough. And so some people really like that. And in an upscale restaurant where people are going to go, you know, buy a $50 entree or a $100 bottle of wine, yeah, they don't want it to read like a, you know, a fast casual menu that anybody could understand and go in there and do. That they want it to be kind of like, they kind of want to be an expert. If you're taking, you know, a group of people out and you're going to buy them dinner and you want to impress somebody, you want to take them to a place where they might not know everything on the menu, but you do, or you might pretend you do, you know, so you're kind of the expert. So menu design in that respect often is very elegant. You know, descriptions can be kind of anywhere from a full paragraph all the way to very, very, you know, quick and, you know, a few words. I think there's a lot of approaches there in the fine dining world that conflict each other because, you know, some chefs really want the entire story of the dish and where it was foraged and all the techniques to be listed right then and there. And then some places actually would prefer that their service staff is the one delivering that message. And so the descriptions are very brief. Another kind of psychological thing to doing the brief descriptions is you really don't have a gauge on what that plate should look like, or maybe you do, and it's completely different. You know, just reading what the words are, I think one of the more surprising things for a lot of diners, and I actually kind of enjoy it myself, is when I read something and I go, oh, that sounds really good. And I'm thinking that it's going to look a certain way, and it comes out and it looks completely different. Obviously that can work, and that, you know, that could go one way or another for you. But I think it's fun when your expectations are kind of smashed, you know, when you have that ability to wow people and go, wow, I had no idea it was going to look like that, you know, but that's
like, they'll just list a few ingredients and it doesn't give you a sense of like how they're assembled.
Exactly. Kind
of
thing. It'll just say like cauliflower, this, that, or whatever, but you don't know that the cauliflower is, you know, cut this way and roasted and, you know, has curry spices on, you know, you just don't have the meat of it. And that can backfire on you too, because, you know, not enough information, like, you know, taking a step down from fine dining and going to like what most Americans eat in like large chain restaurants, large corporate restaurants. If you take that approach, you end up with a lot of complaints because they're like, that's not what I thought I was getting. You know, I think there needs to be some level of familiarity based on the concept. You know, the corporate restaurants are often really smart about, you know, how they lay their menu out. Obviously the standard approach of, you know, starters, you know, mains, sides, and desserts are usually not broken. You usually don't list your side dishes first, but, you know, this is fairly common knowledge, but, you know, it comes down to placement, like where you place things on the menu. The top right corner is one of the most often read areas of a menu for whatever reason. Not really sure why that is. I always jump down to the bottom of the menu. I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's just because of years of working in restaurants, I tend to go to the last first and just kind of work my way back. But, generally, where you place certain items really dictates how well they sell. And we actually played around with that a lot at Poke Poblano. And we had some dishes that we really believed in, but didn't necessarily sell too well. And then when we reprinted our menu, we didn't change a lot about the menu on the first pass, but we just kind of reformatted, restructured, and moved things around into different categories and highlighted a few different dishes. And suddenly those dishes started to sell really well. And some of the dishes that we had success with on our last menu stop selling at all or very little. And so it really became kind of obvious to us, like, okay, what, you know, how we, you know, orient things and how we place things really does have an effect on people. You know, we had a dish there that was a Japanese preparation is a hot stone. Basically it's like a, you know, a piece of granite that comes out on this tray and it's, you know, the stone's been over fire and it's, you know, 600 degrees and you basically cook your own protein at the table. It's kind of an interactive presentation. And when we had that dish front and center on our front page of the menu, and we had it in its own section that kind of took up, you know, a bigger area than any of the other starters, we sold tons of them. And then we reformatted our menu and thought, you know, we didn't want to necessarily just push that. So we kind of lumped it back in with the other starters and the sales dropped at least 25%.
That's really interesting.
And we did nothing different other than just change, you know, where it was and how big, you know, the font was for that one specific dish.
Right. Yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of factors there.
Yeah, it comes down to everything, you know, font choice,
dollar signs
are a huge point of contention for a lot
of
people.
Whether you use dollar signs or just like use, you know, like the number 14 or whatever.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, and that's kind of funny because, you know, I think removing the dollar signs is something that started out kind of in fine dining, but has trickled down all the way down to like fast casual restaurants. A lot of times don't have dollar signs anymore and it's just become kind of expected, but it does confuse people sometimes. I mean, sometimes it makes the menu item look like it reads like whatever the name of the dish is. And then the number 9 is part of, you know, I've had people order like the Italian 9 sandwich, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And so the psychological effect of how you lay it out, you know, a lot of people use pictures in a much more casual restaurant or family restaurant because people like, you know, let's just give like Chili's or Applebee's or any of those restaurants, for example, they put a lot of pictures on their menu because a lot of their guests like to just see what the food's going to look like. You know, but a lot of restaurants don't do that because they, you know, they think that it maybe cheapens their product or maybe puts them in that category and they don't want to, you know, they don't want to relate to that. You know, I've noticed that a lot of, you know, smaller kind of mom and pop Asian restaurants will often have pictures just because maybe, you know, again, you don't know what the dish is going to look like, but if you see what it looks like and it looks good, you're more apt to order it. You know, I think a lot of smaller kind of Asian restaurants love to put either 50 cents or 99 cents or 95 cents at the end of a total, like $8.95, $8.99 instead of $9. Because, you know, old school marketing always told you, you know, $8.99 sounds cheaper than $9, but you'll never see a restaurant who's trying not to appear cheap do that because, you know, it gives the, you know, gives the air of, you know, they're trying to give the perception of value when it's not there.
Yeah. I think about that stuff when I was pricing my books, because I knew it was a, you know, the common strategy was to do like, you know, $18.95 or whatever,
right.
But then it does seem kind of cheap to me. So I was thinking about just switching it to, you know, I went back and forth between having it just be like 20 instead of 19.95.
Right.
And yeah, it's still, like you said, there's a lot of factors there because it can be like, it seems kind of classier to just say what it is as if, and most people see through the like, oh, they want to make it look cheaper. So they're taking 5 cents off,
right,
or whatever, you know? But I also read too, have you heard that a lot of people consider the 95 ending classier than the 99 ending?
Yeah.
Like 99 just seems ridiculous.
Yes. You know, and again, and I don't know how much this plays into it, but again, Asian restaurants, you'll see 99 a lot. And I don't know if that's kind of the MSG effect or not, but people thinking that 99 looks worse than it is. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. It's like they see them doing it and they're like, well, that's
right.
That's low class.
I'm not doing that.
Yeah. Which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of thing. Yeah.
You know,
when you said MSG effect, yeah, maybe we should mention that too, because we're both fans of MSG. And
yes.
if you research MSG, if you read the Wikipedia, for example, on MSG, you'll find there's no evidence that it has any bad effects. It's a natural substance derived from, you know, natural ingredients. It's just a chemical process. There's, you know, MSG has a really bad rap, and I like to, promote it whenever I get a chance.
Yeah, man. MSG for life.
Yeah. MSG, I'm going to get a tattoo.
MSG is one of those things. And I know that it's been touched on a lot, you know, in social media. And I know David Chang did a piece that kind of, debunked some of the perception. But yeah, the common perception is that it's a bad thing. And, you know, I think a lot of it stems, a lot of the theories of why people perceive it as bad is because, you know, originally, you know, when a lot of Asian restaurants started opening up, you know, early on when there weren't a lot of Asian restaurants in America, they would use monosodium glutamate to enhance the flavors of their food. And some of it, I think, is a little bit like based on systemic racism. And I don't want to go to, especially in today's climate,
the exotic foods.
Yeah. It was something that was distrusted amongst the public for whatever reason. And so a lot of restaurants started having to advertise that they didn't use MSG. And so it reinforced the belief that it was bad because they, you know, as a business, they're like, well, all these people don't want to eat here because we use MSG. So we have to put a sign up that says we don't use it anymore,
right,
even if they did,
right.
You know, which I'm sure there were, but it reinforced that belief. And so, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, fun kind of debunking of people in a room all, you know, all quoted saying that they have an allergy to MSG or it makes them feel terrible. And they're passing out, you know, various snacks for them to
right.
pack on while
chips.
They're in this focus group. Yeah, all these chips that are all
that
made
MSG.
In MSG. Yeah, so, and, you know, at the end of the focus group, obviously nobody had a headache and everyone felt fine. And then the, you know, the curtain was pulled back that, oh, you all ate MSG today. And so, yeah, anyway.
So my personal theory, and this is probably something somebody else has written about, but my personal theory was obviously Chinese food is very salty. So I think a lot of people get headaches because of the salt afterwards.
Sure.
And then they clued it in, you know, they associate it with this whole MSG legend, you know?
Right.
And I think that's what happens.
I agree. I think the sugar and salt content in Americanized, you know, Asian food often is much higher than what a lot of people are used to eating. So I think you're right. You know, a lot of times people just correlate, you know,
right,
not feeling as well, you know, it's just, it must be that one chemical, you know, because everything else is normal.
Right.
And,
I've heard about that MSG.
That MSG got me again.
So speaking of the whole upselling thing, because I know that's a tactic people talk about a lot. Is that something that, what do you think of that? And are there things you do to use that? Or is there a chance that kind of drives customers, you know, annoys them? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, in my position over the years, I think upselling kind of became a dirty word with a lot of servers. You know, upselling is a very corporate technique. And so it inherently brings a lot of that attitude of, you know, it's kind of a corporate strategy and kind of seems, you know, money grubbing or, you know, a little greedy at times. you know, I think upselling is kind of morphing into this other concept. I think you sent me an article that touched on this as well, as instead of upselling, you know, it's finding ways to, you know, finding ways to give something, give a guest an option for something that they maybe didn't know they wanted, or maybe they didn't know that we had, or just, you know, finding ways to kind of round out the meal. You know, if you have a table of four and everybody orders, you know, an entree, but they didn't order an appetizer, well, you know, that's a perfect time to say, well, did you guys want to start with something to share? You know, or anytime, you know, there's a lot of restaurants that have built-in upsells. You know, there's a lot of places where you order an entree and it comes with, you know, a side dish, but the soup of the day is, you know, clam chowder. So do you want to add on a, you know, a cup of clam chowder, you know, for your side instead? It's an extra, you know, buck or buck 50. Mm. And, you know, so those built-in upsells, you know, really, really kind of happen on their own. Ultimately, upselling is just part of the technique of trying to get the check average higher. You know, you're in a restaurant industry, your margins are disgustingly slim. You know, I broke it down basically like with a friend of mine the other day. It's like, you are going into a business where your margins are some of the worst in any business. You have between a 5 and 15% margin window, which is generally what people operate in. If you're doing above 15%, you're in the vast minority of restaurants that are doing well. So you have, you know, the worst margins in the world. You're investing your money in a product that can spoil, that you have to bring in and hope that it stays good in your refrigerator long enough to sell. Then you have to sell it to somebody and they have to like it for them to get a return on that initial investment for, you know, one of the worst margins ever. So yeah, it's extremely tight, you know. So increasing check averages is really critical when it comes to, you know, getting better margins in the restaurant industry. You know, if somebody's spending, if your average clientele is spending $15 a person in your restaurant, and you can suddenly get them all to spend $20 a person in your restaurant, that's a really large increase in sales over time. Yeah.
Especially if it's drinks, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Especially on areas that have much better margins. Alcohol is known to have some of the best margins in the, you know, in the entire area. So that's why bars and nightclubs often survive, you know, much longer with maybe less sales, because, you know, their cost of goods is much lower on cheap alcohol.
One thing I like to do at restaurants, because I tend to not like making decisions, I'll ask the server for their recommendation, like, what's your favorite food on the menu?
Yeah, I love doing that.
Yeah, I think you get some good results there. But then sometimes I notice, like, some servers will be like, I haven't really eaten any of this. Is that a bad sign that they haven't eaten the food, or is that the standard?
It could be that you're in a place that sells meat and they're vegan, or, you know, I think it's a bad sign.
Some other thing.
Yeah. So, you know, touching on that, you know, I agree. I like to ask servers what their favorite thing is too. And this goes back to the guest psychological aspect, you know, kind of reading how the server is. You know, you can use psychology as a guest to really kind of understand how adept your server is at their job. You know, if you do ask their favorite, they're like, I don't really know. That's going to clue you in on a lot of things. You know, it's going to clue you in on their work ethic. It's going to clue you in on how detail oriented they are. It's going to clue you in on how, you know, how much they actually believe in the company they work for, how much they're just going through the motions. I mean, it gives you a lot of clues. So, you know, one of the things I think people forget is that, you know, there's a lot of, a lot of things servers forget is that there's a lot of psychological clues and reads that they give off throughout the meal that can be, you know, really triggering for guests. You know, if, like you said, if somebody doesn't really give you the impression that they know what's going on right off the bat, it sends up a red flag right away. You know, in your mind as the guest, you're sitting there going, well, now I don't know, I don't fully trust that my experience is going to be as good as, you know, someone who's sitting in that service section who looks like he's killing it with the crayon behind his ear. You know what I mean? So you have to really watch yourself as a server, because there's a lot of clues that you can give off, you know, and as far as, you know, just how open you are to the table. Are you making eye contact? Are you friendly? You know, are you responding with thoughtful answers? Are you giving the automatic company response? You know, are you trying to upsell things like a robot? Or are you actually suggesting something that you tried today that you thought was an awesome combination? And so, you know, a lot of servers give off, I think, a lot of bad psychological clues, a lot of bad tells, basically, when it comes to them doing their job. And there's a lot of people that approach being a guest as, like, you know, they're doing a server a favor, and to an extent they are doing them a favor by paying some of their, you know, some of their rent every month. But, you know, I've had people put a dollar amount on the table and tell the server, like, you know, I'm going to leave your tip here, but, you know, pick it up at the end. And then anytime something happens that they don't like, they take money out of it. which I think is a really messed up approach. If somebody does that to me right off the bat, like I could care less. I actually had a server tell me one time that they had a table do that, and they were notorious for doing that. And it was her first time taking them, and all the other servers warned them, like, oh, this guy, he always puts $5 $1 bills, and he always takes one away as soon as you don't bring something by. And so
bizarre.
He goes through his speech and he puts the $5 bills on thing. He goes, now this is your tip. And as soon as he said, this is your tip, she snatches off the table and just puts it in her pocket and says, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I'll be back on your dreams. The guy never did it again. You know, the guy never did
got,
it again.
So. Got played.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
But
Snap called him. I feel like some servers try to hide the fact that they're new or not that knowledgeable, and that kind of backfires on them a bit too. It's like, yeah. I can have a real bad service experience, but as long as they're like honest or you know, and they make a show of, you know, saying I screwed up, or like I'm new and I'm learning, like I might even give them a bigger tip then, because I kind of feel bad for them.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually, to be honest, I use that card a lot.
I was gonna say, is that a trick?
Well,
yeah.
No, it is a trick. And I started telling people that, like, I had been serving for months, and there were times where maybe I kind of got a read that these people were going to be a little bit, you know, maybe not the most, maybe a little hard on me, or maybe they weren't going to be, you know, as understanding. Maybe they just had kind of looked like they were maybe not the easiest people to deal with. And so I would start with that and just say, you know what, guys, this is my first week. I'm still learning. But then I would absolutely nail every question they had, because I've been doing it for months, and I would nail the entire thing. And so at the end of the meal, they're leaving going, oh my God, you did such a great job. Like, I can't believe. You know, they would tell my manager, hold on to this one. You know, I know he's new.
This guy's a star.
Yeah, so like, it was kind of hilarious and, you know, a little deceitful, but, again, psychology, you know, it's how do you maximize your money? You know, when you're dealing with people, you know, how do you find the ways?
Yeah, I remember doing that. I think I did that a few times when I was serving too at a sushi restaurant and, an ice cream parlor place I worked at too. Yeah. It was more like if I screwed up, I was trying to save face. I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty new here. Cause news, new is subjective.
Absolutely.
Obviously. So,
absolutely.
You know, 6 months, a year even can be viewed as new.
Yeah. They're tenured employees or 10-year employees. So,
exactly.
Yeah, you're new for
the
first time.
Stretching
the
truth.
Yeah. Honestly, a lot of restaurant work, unfortunately, involves stretching the truth. You know, it really does. And that, even with menus, you know, and even with, you know, it's not a very good practice, but I know there are tons of restaurants, you know, who put, you know, a certain type of product on their menu saying, we only use this. But when that runs out, they're substituting something else. They're not telling you, you know. The best restaurants will tell you, you know, hey, just so you know, we had to make this substitution. Is that okay? If it's not okay, you know, we can probably discount it a little bit for you or whatever. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that.
Well, yeah, and it seems like there's been a lot of articles about that deception on the distributor and like olive oil and fish, you know, like there's so many.
Yeah.
There's so much, apparently, like so much olive oil, even imported olive oil, and that is just, you know, regular vegetable oil or mostly vegetable oil of other sorts. And then there's so many fish, different species of fish that like you literally are like more likely for some of these types of fish to have a fake, you know, version of that fish in a restaurant than the real one. So, yeah, it's kind of rampant deception, it seems like.
Yeah, it definitely can be.
How much does the atmosphere and the like the acoustics and the music and those kind of things, do you have any opinions about that? Because one thing that I heard recently was that plays a big effect in comedy clubs, like how tight and like kind of intimate the setting is, because it amplifies the laughs
definitely.
A lot more in a comedy club.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there was any sort of similar thing like that for restaurants.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the psychology of restaurants starts from the minute you look them up online. You know, we touched on the social media aspect of having a brand that people can see very clearly from, you know, the story you're trying to tell online. But I think the best restaurants kind of draw you into a space. They draw you into kind of a different kind of atmosphere than the norm. You know, if you can kind of get people to feel like they're walking into, you know, another city or another area that, you know, that they're not familiar with, it's really effective. You know, there's a lot of subtle design choices that, you know, the best restaurants really employ to really make the atmosphere feel, you know, kind of cozy at times, but still, you know, intriguing. And, you know, a lot of restaurants use a lot of techniques to kind of draw your eye to different areas of the restaurant so that you kind of, you know, feel like you're comfortable in your space, but you also kind of are curious about, you know, other areas of the restaurant. you know, the restaurants that have the ability to do that are often the large corporate ones or the ones that, you know, the smaller ones that have a lot of money, you know, because that really takes a lot of work. You know, design and decor is a huge kind of part. part of the budget that you don't necessarily have to put into. You know, there's plenty of restaurants where you walk in and it's just a room full of tables, menu on the wall, and a register. And yeah, they, you know, it suffices the needs, but it already, if that walking into that environment preps you for what the expectation is, you know? So if you're trying to offer an experience for guests, then you really have to start by offering them a setting to have that experience. And then the service and the food and everything kind of have to follow suit. But yeah, I mean, everything from lighting to acoustics, you know, at night you want the lighting to come down, but you still want tables to be lit, you know, in ways that people can still see their food, but maybe not feel like they're under a spotlight. Acoustics are very important. You know, we actually had some people consult us on the acoustics at Poblano because it was kind of an open room kind of feel in some parts. And I felt like it was kind of echoey in certain areas. And yeah, we had to kind of troubleshoot a little bit of sound dampening here and there, just because there were some areas where you had great sound for, you know, conducive conversation. And there were some tables where if I was sitting, you know, 3 feet from you across the table, the sound would just kind of get, you know, swallowed by the room. So yeah, it was really interesting. We actually tried to do a comedy night, we did a few comedy nights at Poblano. But what I say tried is the biggest issue was the acoustics. And, you know, we had some people sitting in a different section that wasn't really part of where the comedy was going on, but those conversations were echoing like well into the area where it kind of drowned out some of the comedy stuff. And it really made it feel like it wasn't an intimate area. And I think it made it really hard, you know, having live music is great. You know, again, that's a psychological effect of, oh, there's something happening here. This place is cool.
Feels fancy. Yeah,
it makes people want to stay. It makes people want to hang out because there's something going on in the background, but you know, you're all kind of in the shared kind of experience. And again, though, if you have live music, but it's too loud or too echoey, then it's a deterrent. You know, I've had a lot of guests that were, you know, maybe had hearing issues or just didn't appreciate loud music that, you know, really didn't jive with that whole approach, you know? So really, you know, it kind of alienate us a little bit in some respect.
Speaking of the interior design of the restaurant, yeah, we talked about this a bit before the podcast, but one of our favorite restaurants in Portland is this ramen place, Japanese place, Maru, and they have a few locations. Each location has a different name, but it's owned by this large Tokyo-based conglomerate that owns like 100 restaurants or something, but they just do the decor so well that it's kind of hard to say for me how much my enjoyment of the place stems from the decor and the vibe in there and how much comes from the food. I mean, the food is obviously is objectively really good, but it's also like, I just get something from this cool vibe that they've established in there. And it's like, obviously, like you said, it's something that it's a corporate entity, and they've obviously put a lot of work and science and philosophy into the layout of this thing. And it's kind of like, it gives this sense that you're in this outdoor area, you know, it has like almost like little cart things, structures, you know, above the cooking area and the sushi making area. So it gives you the sense that you're in this outdoor kind of food market kind of area.
Like, an alleyway, an alleyway in Tokyo.
Yeah. Kind of tight spaces, but not too tight. And yeah, it's just the vibe. And when you had pointed out some of those things, I realized that I had seen a little bit of it, but I hadn't really gotten what was appealing about it. And yeah, there's this interplay of like the places that we like the most are, there's probably a lot of unconscious things going on there about why we like them. Like maybe we grew up in a house or had a grandparents that had similar furniture to, you know, something they're using in there or whatever it is that makes you feel comfortable and nostalgic or something, or maybe it's a place you visited that you loved or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, decor is really critical. And like you said, you know, they did a great job with making it feel like you're transported into another space or another place. You know, you walk in there and it did feel very reminiscent of like an alleyway in Tokyo that had a bunch of little, I believe it's a izakaya or something like that. You know, it's like a bar. It's like a Japanese pub, but they're, you know, these pubs are, you know, often just like a counter with 5 seats. You know what I mean? And then there's another one next door. And then there's another one next door that serves, you know, one guy's serving ramen, the next guy's doing sushi, you know, whatever. And so that's kind of that whole, you know, really tight downtown Tokyo grimy kind of, you know, grassroots, like this is where you go to find the best ramen. Yeah, they did a great job of recreating that that kind of environment. You know, and I've often said that I feel like some of the coolest restaurants I've been in and some of the ones that are the most fun almost always tie in elements of outdoors inside, you know, whether it's bringing trees inside or making the ceiling look like it's a night sky, or adding, you know, balcony kind of looking things, you know, like you'd see in New Orleans where there's like a, you know, a second story balcony with windows. Like, even if they're just false windows, you know, those kind of elements, when you bring those inside, it really transports people and it really kind of changes their whole perception of what's going on. I mean, you know, that restaurant did an amazing job with just creating that homegrown feel, you know, from every detail down to the, you know, the seats and the, you know, the woodworking and even the menu and the font choices they used and, you know, the way they did it, it made it feel very, very, you know, independent owner. And that's a brilliant choice on their respect, because I would think that, especially in Portland, the market would much rather support, you know, local or home, you know, homegrown independent owners than these huge corporate, you know, chains. Like, I don't remember seeing a lot of like TGI Fridays and various things like that in Portland. You know what I mean? I don't think they get a lot of people supporting that, because Portland's a very kind of different market. You know, they're very community based and neighborhood based. And so for a Japanese company, you know, with hundreds of locations and billions of dollars, to kind of recognize that and come into Portland and open that and really kind of offer that, you know, that kind of perception is really just telling, like, you know, how much goes into the whole thing and really how smart, you know, the business really can be if you have enough people working on it with you.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder, like, if you polled people coming out of that, like, how many people would actually guess that that was not some huge, you know, conglomerate? How many people would be thinking like, that's a smaller group of restaurants?
No, at first glance, I think most of us, you know, would think that it was a small place. You know, I definitely thought that, you know, it was a Portland-based company. Mm-hmm. You know, I obviously, some of the detail work and some of the aesthetic and what they were doing, I said, okay, well, they're obviously doing well. They have a lot of money. You know what I mean? So they've figured out something that works, but it made a lot more sense when we started to understand that, you know, these were multi-million dollars worth of decision makings. Yeah. Going into it. And, you know, some of the clue there too was their service staff. You know, if you looked at how their service staff was operating, they were upbeat. They were very thorough. They were, you know, very, you know, friendly. They used a lot of eye contact. There was a kind of a corporate kind of feel to the service staff and manager. You know, the manager was very pleasant, and, you know, they looked, you know, the staff kind of looked more of like a corporate staff than anything. Nothing else in that restaurant really stuck out to me as this might be a chain, but the staff, you know, and that's honestly, you know, that didn't bother me. I think they did a great job with it. So.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. If anybody's comes to Portland and wants to eat there, it's called Maru. It's got a longer name, Yadamara Maru or something like that.
Oh, but man, that ramen though is delicious.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah. Super tasty.
And they got a full vegan menu, not full, but they have a smaller, separate vegan menu too. And they have four locations in Portland. So, recommend that. I had a few questions that people sent me that weren't directly tied to like psychology. So I think I'll send you those and maybe I'll put them on the blog if you answer a few.
Sure.
And if people are curious about that, the blog's at readingpokertells.video/blog. And again, Robin does some, he's available for some consulting for, you know, restaurant operations or strategy or opening, things like that. He's in Albuquerque these days. You can find him. Let me see what I have your Twitter here. One second. He's new to Twitter, but his Twitter is Dibble Robin. That's D-I-B-B-L-E Robin, R-O-B-I-N. And he's on Instagram with a very hard to communicate title. It's Dr._Dibbs. So Dr. Dibbs.
I think if you search Dr. Dibbs, it should be what pops up first.
There
might be one space or two. Dibbs. Yeah, if you just search Dr. Yeah, space Dibbs.
You definitely didn't make that easy on anyone.
Yeah, I was trying to go for the hardest to dictate. Yeah.
It's contrary and it's cool.
Good business decision, you know, very calculated.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's mystery, you know, it's like making your restaurant hard to get to or something, you know.
Right. Speakeasy Instagram approach.
Yeah. All right. Cool. This has been a great talk. Thanks for coming on, Robin.
Yeah, man. It was an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate it. And thank you all for listening.